WBD News. I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. For the next few minutes of WGT's morning show, we're going to suggest that you think differently about the word selfish. It's obviously a word that carries very negative connotations for most of us, but it is not being used in a negative way by my morning show guest, Michelle Ellman. She has written a new book called The Joy of Being Selfish, and the subtitle really tells us more about the intent and focus of this book, why you need boundaries and how to set them. It is Michelle Ellman's contention that for us to really live happy and fulfilled and meaningful lives and to make our way successfully through the world in both our personal and professional relationships, it really makes sense for us to understand the significance and importance of boundaries. How to set them, how to maintain them, and how to respect them when it comes to the boundaries of others. Michelle Ellman is an accredited life coach and activist. You may know her name because of a campaign that she began called Scarred, Not Scared, which falls in line with one of the most important themes in her work, namely body positivity. Her debut book, actually, from I think now several years ago, is titled Am I Ugly? One Woman's Journey to Body Positivity. And she has a podcast, which is called In All Honesty. But today we'll focus most of our attention on this new book published by Welbeck titled The Joy of Being Selfish, Why You Need Boundaries and How to Set Them. Michelle Ellman, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks for having me on.
I'm glad we can have this conversation. I think it might be good for us to have our listeners understand a little more about who you are and where you come from. And in particular, this campaign of yours called Scarred, Not Scared, which folds very much into the theme of your first book, Am I Ugly? Tell our listeners whatever you think will be helpful for them in terms of having some context for today's conversation.
Yes, so I was a life coach and one day decided to post a picture of myself in a bikini on Instagram, my first bikini, and it went viral, which is a very unusual thing to happen because as much as bikini pictures probably get a little more attention, usually your bikini picture doesn't go quite viral across the world, but mine did because my stomach is covered in surgery scars from 15 surgeries that I had before the age of 19. And that is where the campaign Scarred Not Scared started from, was the first time I was wearing a bikini and basically declaring that scars should be a part of the body positive conversation. Scars are wonderful. They help you survive, and that we shouldn't be hiding them or ashamed of them. And that if you have surgery scars, you shouldn't be embarrassed. Or when I was younger, I remember the actual first time I wore a bikini and then promptly ran into the changing room crying. I was 10 years old, and my scars were met with looks of pity, shock, horror. And it was my way of trying to normalize these conversations, because what I couldn't understand was so many people go into hospital having surgeries, yet by the age of 21, I hadn't seen a single person with a surgery scar except for myself. And so it was about making sure that all those people who are going into hospital aren't walking out with the same insecurities that I carried for way too long.
So you post this photograph of yourself in which you are, in effect, showing the whole world your scars, the scars on your body. And explain the scope of the response and how many women actually responded with photographs of their own.
The response was quite large, definitely not in a way that you expect it, where I was, when I say I was going viral, I was having articles in Australia, doing interviews in America, Ireland, all across the world. My cousin in Israel saw me in the newspaper, and you really don't think posting a bikini picture is ever going to result in people printing it in a newspaper. But the results, the responses I was getting were largely from people with scars saying, oh my God, I've never seen someone who looks like me. And then people not with people who don't have scars saying that they had never thought about it. And they never considered that you staring at someone in the street, whether your scar is on your stomach or your face, I have the option to hide it if I don't want to talk about it. But if someone has a scar on their face and you stare at them down the street, that's how the insecurity usually starts. Because as I said, I'd grown up with them. And so it was when I was 10 years old and people stared at me. No one said anything, but it was the stares that when someone looks at you with pity in your eyes, essentially what pity is saying, I'm so glad I'm not you. And it's not a very pleasant feeling. So when I was getting these responses, it was actually the responses from people who didn't have scars that really made me feel like the conversation was changing. Because if people are thinking about it, that's how they can be more considered in their reactions when they see someone with a scar in real life.
So you were not prepared for just how huge an impact this was going to have. You go on to write your debut book, Am I Ugly? One Woman's Journey to Body Positivity. Explain the connection between that book and the book that you have just written that we are going to be talking about today, called The Joy of Being Selfish, which explores this whole notion of boundaries. What is the through line behind where all of this began and where what you're talking about now?
I actually started writing Am I Ugly when I was 12 years old in English class. So it was actually written way before that photo became viral. But essentially, my biggest pain in my life was this insecurity. And so it was almost shocking to me getting to 21 and being like, oh, wow, I'm not insecure about my scars anymore. I'm confident about them. And then realizing, oh, I can love my body and not like myself. And that's where this next step became my next project, I guess. Where I was like, wow, okay, so I now love my body, I love my scars, I'm not insecure about my body in any way, but what's left is I'm not sure I like spending time with myself, I'm not sure I love myself, and I don't stand up for myself. And that's where I was like, okay, so how can I change this? And especially at that point, I was around 21, I just found everywhere I looked, from my boyfriend to my friends, I had people in my life who just did not respect me. So no matter how much I loved my body, it's really hard to love yourself when everyone around you is telling you how unlovable you are, maybe not in those exact words. And that's where boundaries came in. And so boundaries to me, my definition, is it teaches the world how to treat you. It's the line between who you are and who the world wants you to be. And that was my necessary next step, was learning how to set boundaries, stand up for myself. And unfortunately, the consequence of that is you do tend to lose all those people in your life, because once you start saying no, it starts becoming less convenient for the people who only keep you around for what you're useful for, as opposed to actually liking you for the person you are, the human you are, and your inherent worth.
We're speaking with Michelle Elman. We're talking about her latest book called The Joy of Being Selfish, Why You Need Boundaries and How to Set Them. Before we explore some of the specific things you talk about concerning boundaries, could we spend a moment just talking about this word selfish? As I noted in the introduction, and I didn't even really need to spell it out as I did, most people, nearly everybody I can think of, looks at the word selfish in very negative terms. I mean, we don't ever consider it a compliment if we are called selfish or we call someone else selfish. So it's an interesting choice on your part to use this particular word in the title of your book. Can you explain that decision, that choice, why you feel like selfish is the word that you want right at the top of the masthead?
Yeah, so I was in this world of body positivity, and alongside body positivity, there are a lot of conversations around self-care and self-love. And I just found it a bit interesting that everyone is on board with the word self-care and self-love. You say selfish, and they're like, whoa, too far. But the thing is, for you to make time for self-care and self-love, you do need to be more selfish. And it's not optional. So, for example, if you are exhausted, you need time to yourself. You need to have a weekend. You need to ignore your boss's need for you to reply to an email in order to actually have that weekend. And so when people think, oh, okay, I'll do self-care and self-love, but only after every single other person in my life is taken care of, there's no time and energy left. And so if you start putting yourself higher in your priority list, you do need to be selfish. And I do think it's almost the best favor you can do to every single person in your life. Because I don't know about you, but if you have a person in your life who never takes care of themselves, you spend your entire time worrying about them and are concerned because they never make time for themselves. Whereas if they actually started taking care of themselves, it would be like that job is removed off your list. The other reason I use the word selfish in the title is because it's a common comeback to when you set boundaries. And I don't think setting boundaries is selfish, but if someone's going to call me selfish for setting boundaries, fine, so be it. You want to label me as selfish? Go ahead. It's not the worst word in the world. And so by putting it on the title, it almost removes the stigma of it. And it takes the sting out of it. I quite like putting controversial words in my titles. It was the same way with the word ugly in my first book, that, like, you call me ugly now. It means nothing to me. I've been called ugly so many times now that it's been my book title. Same way with selfish. Like, you think that's because I'm making decisions to take care of myself? Cool. So be it.
Interesting. It sort of disarms the word and its impact. And it's interesting, as we're just talking about this, I'm realizing that selfish, whether in kind of the normal connotation or in the connotation that you're using it, I've never really stopped to take the word apart in that first syllable, self. When we're saying someone, maybe we're being selfish, it's about the self. And in a sense, I suppose it's a variety on related words like self-centered.
Or selfless. So the opposite is selfless. And selfless is the word that is used as the greatest compliment, especially with women. You say a woman is selfless, it's like, wow, she must be Mother Teresa. She must, like, be amazing. And actually, I just don't think selfless people should be the highest compliment. What it's essentially saying, you are only good enough if you completely forget yourself. And I think you can be a good person and still regard yourself and consider yourself as an important factor to take in when you're considering everyone's needs and wants.
Well, let's move beyond the word selfish to the word boundary and make sure that we understand exactly how you are using that term. What do you mean when you say that we need to set boundaries? What is your definition of a boundary?
So boundaries to me are all about treatment, what is and isn't acceptable about how someone treats you. And so it could be you saying, don't speak to me that way, or it could be you saying, please stop commenting on my body. It could be you saying to a boss, if I'm going to keep working weekends, then I need more compensation. It's all about treatment, and it's all about... Mm.
I like how you say... I think I heard you describing it this way, telling people what is and isn't acceptable. So when it comes to the way others treat you, setting boundaries. I think it is so interesting. You say at one point in the book, the most challenging part about setting boundaries is that we often don't feel we deserve to set them. That is probably an extremely crucial point, and one that maybe we might not stop to consider. But all that follows in the book doesn't matter at all if you don't, in the first place, believe that you have the right, that you deserve to be able to set your own boundaries. How would you have somebody who maybe struggles with that concept come to terms with that?
Absolutely. I have a coaching exercise, which everyone almost looks at me in shock when I say it. But if you don't believe something, the fastest way to change that belief is to write 100 reasons why you should. So I've done it before with 100 reasons why someone would want to date me, 100 reasons why someone would want me as their client, who would want me as their life coach, all of these things. But you can also do 100 reasons why you deserve to set boundaries. And it's about building that evidence file, that proof file, to be bigger than the evidence file you hold in your head that you don't deserve to set boundaries. And ultimately, when it comes, it's a belief. Believing you don't deserve to set boundaries is neither fact nor fiction. It is just a belief. And therefore, to change a belief, you need to start providing evidence for it. And so that's what you do. When you have more reasons why you deserve to set boundaries and reasons why you shouldn't, then you actually have those answers in your head every time you feel guilt for setting a boundary, or your brain tells you, oh, I can't say that, like that's really rude. Well, no, it's not rude. You just deserve to set boundaries. Hmm.
I think it's interesting, a distinction you make at one point, I think it's in the introduction to the book, where you tell us that boundaries and walls are not the same thing. And I'm really glad you take the time to explore this, because I think probably for some people, when they think about the notion of a person who is very carefully and deliberately setting all kinds of boundaries about the way they want others to treat them, that it's really easy to concoct this picture of a person who is, in a sense, walled off by others. Explain a little more about this distinction between these two terms and why you think it's a distinction that is important to highlight and very important to understand.
Well, I found this most with boundaries becoming used in everyday language, that it's a word that most people have heard now, but they don't understand the meaning of it. And so therefore, I was seeing a lot of these conversations, especially online, of people going, well, that's my boundary. Or someone saying, I remember someone personally, a friend saying to me, well, that made me feel, I said, I'm not staying in this conversation, because she was saying rude things. And she went, well, it's my boundary. You can't leave the conversation midway. And I was like, well, that's not how it works. You can't set a boundary around my behavior. You can set a boundary, and you can't set a boundary around how you feel, but you can't insist on me not leaving a conversation, because it's also my boundary that I'm not going to let someone speak to me that way. And so it's about, so the difference between walls and boundaries is that boundaries keep the people you don't want out, and walls keep everyone out. And so a lot of the times when these people set walls, it's not actually out of a self-protection or a way to stand up for themselves, but more so out of the fear that any form of connection or any form of intimate discussion would lead to rejection. And so it's a defensive act. And that's why we need to learn the difference between walls and boundaries. Mm. And also there's an element with walls where it's like, boundaries, but with no flexibility. And you need an element of flexibility with boundaries.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? I mean, generally speaking, at least, walls are inflexible. I mean, you build them and they are what they are. And generally speaking, impenetrable and certainly not flexible. And so the word boundary has kind of a connotation of flexibility built into it. Another distinction you make in this part of the book that I find intriguing as well is when you say a wall is to keep a person out, a boundary helps us know the difference between me and you. So they serve very different functions. Can you say a little more about that, that notion that a boundary helps us know the difference between me and you? How does a boundary do that?
So a boundary is all about me. It's about what I want. It's about my treatment. So it's not about me dictating your behavior. It's not about me trying to control you anyway, because every boundary that you set has a consequence. So if I say to you, I don't want to talk about this anymore, and if you continue talking about it, I'm going to leave the room, then that's not me forcing your decision. That's giving you a choice and me saying, this is about me. It's not personal. It's not about the fact that I hate you and I hate this conversation. It's about, I don't like what you're talking about, whether that's my weight or actually I had someone this morning use an example of like a racist conversation. And if you don't want to stay in the room for it, that is your right, because I don't have to participate in a conversation I don't want to be in. And so it's when you set boundaries, it's, I guess the equivalent of a wall would be you storming off or you yelling at that person being like, shut up. That would be a wall. Instead, you setting a boundary is, I'm giving you a warning. We have to stop this conversation. Otherwise, this is what's going to happen. I'm not controlling your behavior. I'm telling you this is the difference between me and you. You're happy in this conversation. I'm not happy in this conversation.
We're speaking with Michelle Ellman, and we're talking about her newest book, which is called The Joy of Being Selfish, Why You Need Boundaries and How to Set Them. Before we move further, I want to mention something, maybe confess something, and that is that as I read your book, I read it very much through the lens of a woman writing to other women. And I don't remember any place in the book where you overtly state that. I think that is kind of a conclusion that I carelessly drew as I read the book. And could we just talk for a moment about that, whether or not what you are offering here was indeed meant primarily for women, or if this is something that both men and women need to be reading and need to be thinking about in terms of their lives?
I didn't consciously write it for women, but do I think women struggle with boundaries more? And do I think more women are going to be reading my book? Yes. I think what I've found, and to be honest, I've discovered it most in my dating life, is when I tell someone who I'm messaging on a dating app, oh, I'm writing a book about boundaries, or at the time I was writing a book about boundaries, it's obviously now out, they would go, oh, what's boundaries? Whereas I would never get that response from women. And what I decided was that men were saying, what are boundaries? Because either they were so second nature to them, they never had to learn the word for it, versus some men who were so used to setting walls that they never even had the chance to set boundaries. So I think, are there men who have never learned how to set boundaries? Yes, but I think there's a societal pressure on women to be selfless, to be the caretakers of the world. And therefore, that's often why women struggle more. But there absolutely are men who struggle setting boundaries as well.
Right. I'm one of them in the sense that one of the things you spend some time talking about in the book is the importance of being able to say no, which is something I struggle with terribly, maybe not as much as I used to, but nevertheless, still, that is not an easy word for me to say. And you tell us that I think for you, this notion of being willing to say no was, I think for you, your first introduction to this whole notion of setting boundaries. And that the first time we say no, not in the sense of a 3-year-old saying, you know, no, I won't give you this toy or whatever, but a more sort of thoughtful no, that the first time we say that, we are setting a boundary that perhaps we've never set before. Maybe you'd like to share with our listeners the personal story that you tell in the book about the first time that you remember as kind of a semi-mature youngster saying the word no.
Yeah, so I had made this decision. I was going to have a year of saying no. And I was going to say no to anything I didn't want to do or didn't serve me, which is sometimes you have to say yes to work things, which I don't exactly want to do the work thing, but I do want the money that comes with it. Therefore, I'm saying yes. Mm-hmm. But saying no, and the other clause of it was to not give a reason why, because I found that even when I was saying no, I was giving such a long list of reasons that I would feel so guilty. And that, to be honest, every time you give a reason for your no, it becomes a reason someone else pokes a hole in your no. So if you say, no, I can't come to that party because I'm working, they'll go, well, how about you work this evening? And then you won't have to work at the weekend and you can come to my party. So I set this New Year's resolution, actually, in January 2018, I want to say. And there had been 6 days gone by. There was nothing I didn't want to do. And then it was the end of a work day, and a friend invited me to a pub quiz. And I usually love pub quizzes, but I was so out of practice of saying no that when he invited me, I said yes before even asking myself whether I wanted to go. And I hung up. And I remember going, oh, I'm so tired. It's really far. It's halfway across London. I really just want to stay in and watch TV by myself and go to bed early. But I already said yes so instinctually, almost as a knee-jerk reaction, that I didn't even ask myself. So I had to call him back. And I was like, I'm not coming anymore. And he was like, why? I was like, oh, just because then I couldn't give a reason. And it was the most clumsy, awkward conversation, but it was like this epiphany that I realized when I was saying yes to things, I wasn't even consciously saying yes to things, let alone saying no to things consciously. It was like, if I got invited, I automatically said yes, because I was so honored and grateful I was invited and being included, that I didn't actually consider whether I wanted to go. And so it was about taking that moment to pause. And I did speak to that friend years later about this conversation, and he was like, yeah, it was awkward and confusing because you always come to the pub quiz. And I was like, well, I don't come to everything anymore. I have to ask myself, do I actually want to go? And then I'll tell you no.
Right. You characterize that sort of fear or the compulsion of saying yes to every invitation, FOMO, the fear of missing out, which I think a lot of people can relate to. I thought one of the most interesting sentences in this section of the book where you talk about the importance of being willing to say no. You say, if we are unable to use it effectively, that is the word no, our lives are decided by others and we become a victim to our own life.
To be honest, we become a victim of our own calendar.
Right. And, you know, I don't think I've ever stopped to really think about that, about how much we end up giving up when we give up the whole notion of saying no. And I think for me, in terms of my own life and circumstances, which we don't need to go into now, I think part of what motivates me often to not say no when someone asks something of me is this notion that you talk about of us exaggerating our own importance in someone else's life. That sometimes when we find ourselves saying yes to things we really aren't all that excited about, or maybe even really don't want to do, we're saying yes because we think that this person, in a sense, needs us much more than they do. And so there's something kind of self-aggrandizing about refusing to say no.
Yes, there's this thing in psychology called the spotlight effect, which means that we always think everyone's thinking about us when we walk in a room and we're by ourselves, and you have that moment being like, everyone's staring at me because I'm standing by myself. No, they aren't. That's just the spotlight effect. And in the same way, when you say no, you have that same sensation where, personally for me, and the story I tell within the book, is that my housemate wanted to throw a party, and we've never thrown a party separately before, and I couldn't figure out a way to say no. Can you throw the party by yourself, and can I just stay in my bedroom and not come out and not entertain anyone? But, and then I remember trying to explain it to my own life coach, and I was like, oh, but she's going to really struggle with all the, like, there's so much to prepare, and there's a lot to tidy up. Is a 24-year-old capable of throwing a party by herself and tidying up? Yes, absolutely. Was this a story I was making up in my head to make myself seem important? Absolutely. And then it took me a second to go, is she capable of doing it by herself? Yes. And is me assuming that she is so helpless and she won't have any fun without me and I am so necessary to the party's success a really arrogant assumption? Yes, it is. And so it was a kind of that wake-up call, being like, let people be capable enough to do things themselves, because as much as, like, there's more harmful consequences of thinking everything is about you and won't function without you, but also the impact it's having on everyone else is you actually have, like, an assumed helplessness of the people around you, that you feel like they need your presence in order to have fun, or they need you to pick up their laundry, otherwise they can't do it themselves, or they need you to cook dinner, otherwise they'll starve. No, they won't. They'll figure out another way to cook dinner.
We're speaking about Michelle Elman's book, The Joy of Being Selfish, Why You Need Boundaries and How to Set Them. One of the things you spell out in your book is, I believe, 5 different types of boundaries: material, physical, emotional, intellectual, sexual. Maybe you could just take a moment to kind of run down that list and help us understand if the distinctions between these different kinds of boundaries are important for us to consider when it comes to setting boundaries, and maybe those boundaries that some people might really have trouble with setting.
Yeah, so material boundaries are things like, don't borrow my clothes without asking me first. I'm going to forget one of them, but I'm going to try my best. Sexual boundaries are quite self-explanatory, but it's not just in the context of the bedroom. It could be the text someone's sending, or it could be the way someone's speaking to you, the nickname they use, all of those kind of things. Or it could be a sexual act which you don't feel comfortable with, and coercion comes under that umbrella. There is emotional boundaries, so trying to not control someone else's opinion is a great example of that, letting someone else have a different opinion to you and not needing you both to agree. What's the one I'm missing? Physical boundaries. The best physical boundary you have is your skin, but it's about respecting someone's space, and it's even when someone's standing a little bit too close to you, maybe a stranger is standing a bit too close to you, especially now in COVID times, that is your physical boundary being crossed.
Interesting. One of the things you do in your book is outline some of the barriers to boundary setting, where I suppose it would be a way to think about some of those things that might sort of trip us up, make it not easy to set a given boundary. What are some of the most common barriers of which we should be aware?
I think probably the top two, I would say, is the fear of being disliked and also the guilt that comes with boundary setting. So the fear of being disliked, that's essentially why we say yes so often, because we want everyone to like us. And you saying no will make you a more unlikable person. In fact, there will probably be more people who hate you because you're harder to take advantage of and you're harder to manipulate as well. And then also the guilt after setting boundaries, that very related to the fact that you don't feel like you deserve to set boundaries. And if it's not your norm, then it will be such a change to you that you will feel this guilt. But what I say in the book is there's a distinction between appropriate guilt and inappropriate guilt. So appropriate guilt would be if you knock someone with a car, you should feel guilty. That's your conscience. Inappropriate guilt is, the number of times I've said sorry to a door because I walked into the door and then I felt guilty for, like, leaving the door open. It's like, I didn't see it. that's inappropriate guilt, and it fires because there is a meaning you're taking away from it, like you're a bad person. So if you are saying no to a party and you're telling yourself, oh, I'm a bad person because I'm not going to this party and they really wanted me at the party and I'm letting them down, then of course you're going to feel guilt. But you have to remember it's not the decision you made or the action you made. It's the meaning you're telling yourself. That's the problem. And so the meaning of I'm a bad person for doing this is the part you need to work on.
Explain what the stages of boundary setting are.
Yeah, so there are seven stages, and if I go through all of them, I will definitely forget one of them. But they are my mnemonics that I use. Conveniently, spells out selfish. So you start with S, the stories that you tell yourself, and oftentimes when something goes wrong and you need to have that difficult conversation, it's really easy to tell yourself stories about it. So the example I use in the book is if a partner is staying out late and hasn't texted you and you're up worrying about them, then you could tell yourself the story that they don't care about you, that they're cheating on you, that they don't think about you, that they don't love you, they're not calling because they don't care about how you feel. All of that is a story, and it's making yourself feel worse. What is the truth? The truth is they stayed out late and they didn't text you. That's all you need to know. Go from that point of view. Because if you add this elaborate story, half true, half not true, then you come into the conversation of boundary setting with a lot more emotions that aren't based on what's actually happening in front of you. And if you want to read the book, you can see the other seven steps, and it takes you through on how to set the boundary and hold the boundary, and those are the last two of the seven.
You also talk about how we need to be setting boundaries in various contexts of our lives. And I suspect that as people have been listening to this conversation thus far, they've probably sort of focused on a particular context, maybe the workplace, or in their friendships, or in their romantic relationships. But you know, chances are people maybe neglect boundaries in particular contexts, and in other contexts, maybe for a given person, it's easier to set boundaries. Is that the way it has played out, for instance, in your own life?
Yes, absolutely. I think there is always a context that's going to be the easiest for you. For me, that was work. I always found it was just boundary setting was part of being professional. So I found it really easy within work to say, that's not going to work for me. I don't want to do that. No, you're not paying me that enough. Like, all of these things were very easy sentences. Ask me to set boundaries in my love life, though, that was impossible. And I think for me, it was because that within work, I don't care about being liked, whereas in my love life, of course, I care about being liked. And that's where the conflict comes in. But in general, I do think the area of life that most people find hardest to set boundaries are probably family, just because they are the longest relationships you've had, and the patterns of behavior are much more ingrained when, especially there's that family line of, well, that's the way it's always been done. And so it can be really hard to change the dynamics when they are that ingrained.
Is it possible to wrongly set a boundary? I mean, a boundary that, in effect, disrespects someone else, or do we really need to think about boundaries in a way in which any boundary that feels right to me is right for me, and I should have the right to set that boundary as I see fit?
I think there is a there's a wrong way to set a boundary. I think your boundaries are valid, though. I think, so for example, if you were to set a boundary screaming, you're automatically setting a boundary wrong, because a boundary should be set with your emotions removed. But if you are saying, well, it's my boundary to take your shoes off when you come into the house. So this actually happened to me last night, which is why it came to me. I don't like people wearing shoes in my house. I have carpet, I don't like it. There are some people, there are some of my friends, who wear shoes in their own houses. But it's not their right to tell me that I can't have my own boundaries or that my boundaries can be different. Another example is probably quite a relatable one. In relationships, some people don't like their partner being friends with the opposite sex, for example. That's a boundary which I personally believe is unacceptable. I wouldn't be in a relationship with someone who had that boundary. But are you allowed to have that boundary? Yes, but you need to find someone else who would be in a relationship who would agree with that. In terms of my boundaries, however, I think you should trust your partner, and I don't think having a friend of the opposite gender means I'm attracted to them or that I'm going to do anything or there are any romantic feelings involved at all. But that's where everyone's allowed to have different boundaries, but do be careful about how you communicate them.
Right. And of course, that really underscores the point that there are consequences when we set boundaries. And one hopes that most of the consequences will be very positive for us and for those in our lives. But once in a while, if we set a boundary that maybe is a bit unreasonable as far as others are concerned, there will be consequences for that as well. I think that the example you shared was a really good example of that. And actually, what we have just been touching on, I think, takes us nicely to a place in the book when you spell out the five C's, that is the letter C, the five C's that should be part and parcel to the boundaries that we set for our lives. Calm, compassionate, clear, concise, consistent. Can you talk us through each one of those and to underscore their importance?
Yeah, so the calm one is essentially what I was saying around the lack of emotional intensity in the conversation. And then consistent is you can't set a boundary and then change your mind 2 seconds later. You're allowed to change your boundaries, but it's about if you're setting a boundary, you need to keep the same goals. You need to keep the same. So let's say your boundary is that trying to come up with them now. Let's say your boundary is that you don't want people to be talking about your body. If you only set the boundary once and then the next time they do it, you completely forget about it, then you might as well not set the boundary. So it needs to be consistent. The compassionate part is about going into all your relationships with a tiny benefit of the doubt. So you have to assume the best of the person, and boundaries never have to be mean. To be clear, so that's a third C, I think, or fourth, you have to... Someone needs to know what you exactly want out of it. Sometimes when people set boundaries, they speak for like 10 minutes. By the end of the 10 minutes, the person has no clue what you're actually asking for. So make it as simple as possible for me, or the next act, concise as possible. The next C, that was a dyslexic moment.
No problem.
As concise as possible, where... The way I phrase it is, next time I prefer if you, and just make it really obvious what you want and what you're asking for.
And so being concise and being consistent also matter quite a lot. And it's interesting how each of these sort of folds into the other. And one of the things that you also talk about when it comes to boundaries has to do with the amount of information that we share, in a sense, our level of privacy. And in fact, at one point in the book, you encourage us to think very carefully about the notion of privacy versus the notion of honesty. And I think one of the things you touch on here is the tendency of some to be a bit overindulgent with information, and we sometimes don't think about the consequences of doing that. Can you say a word about that?
Yeah, I also think we generally live in a culture of oversharing, and it not only doesn't protect you, but to be on the receiving end of it can actually make you quite uncomfortable. So I use the example of my online profile. I have quite a number of followers now. And sometimes that means people feel entitled to information that I want to keep private. So, for example, I have my own boundaries online of I don't share my family on my page, not only because it's my page, and my family didn't choose to have a public life. But also because my family don't want to be on there. My sister doesn't want her kids on Instagram, and so I don't post pictures of them. I might mention them, but I don't put their names. I don't put any of their information. Same with dating. I don't mention any guy I'm dating by name on there. And it's about a respect for their privacy, but also if that means if someone, one of my followers asks, well, what's your boyfriend's name or what's your sister's name? I'm not going to answer those questions, and I can just say no.
A last thing I want us to cover, we just have a couple minutes left, and this comes to the point where sometimes when we are setting these boundaries, it means actually removing certain people from our lives, certain people whose presence in our lives is largely toxic. As you talk about this, you quote what apparently is a favorite saying of yours. I'm sorry, a saying from somebody else that is a favorite saying of yours, which is this: you are the five people you spend the most time with. And this is a really interesting notion. And, of course, I think a lot of people maybe do not stop to consider the people they are spending the most time with and if those are the people who should occupy that primary position in their lives. How would you have us think about this and act upon this concern?
Yeah, so even on a small level, I remember dating a guy who always used the words iconic and epic, which isn't really in my, like, it's not a word I use very often, but dating him for 2 months meant I was suddenly calling everything epic and iconic, and I usually call things lovely and wonderful, and suddenly I was going epic and iconic every 2 seconds. And if that's just language, think about that in terms of behavior, how much their behavior wears off on you. And so if it's, even if it's something like the person is a very decisive person, living with a decisive person will make you more decisive, and you wear off on each other. So if someone has bad boundaries, then you're going to constantly be crossing their boundaries because they won't communicate it. But also, you'll find it more difficult to set your own boundaries because they're never setting their boundaries with you. And so it's about being very conscious about who you have in your life. And when you have people who you have toxic dynamics with, maybe they talk about you behind your back, a lot of the time that behavior isn't just isolated to a singular incident, but it's repetitive. And so if you don't set boundaries around it, then there's ultimately no consequence. If we go back to the five C's, then I forgot which one it was. There's no consequence to it, and therefore it's not consistent. That's the one I was thinking of. And so that's why you ultimately have to have this ultimate consequence of if someone doesn't respect your boundaries, then they don't respect you, and maybe they don't deserve a place in your life.
Well, I have to say that your book gave me an awful lot to think about, and I really appreciated the opportunity to explore it and now to discuss it with you. And I suspect our listeners have been given a lot to think about as well. The book, again, is titled The Joy of Being Selfish, Why You Need Boundaries and How to Set Them. The book is published by Welbeck and the author, Michelle Ellman. Michelle Ellman, thank you so much for your time, and thank you so much for sharing with the world this intriguing book.
Thank you so much. It was lovely talking to you.
Tomorrow on the morning show, John Winkle from the Racine Symphony previews their next Lakeside Pops concert. And we hear from the authors of The Everyday Leader, 14 Marine Corps Traits to Unlock Your Leadership DNA. On Wednesday, John Seeger, President and CEO of Population Connection, a nonprofit, nonpartisan group working for the cause of population stabilization around the world. Nan Calvert is with us on Thursday with Deanna Nicky, who is a restoration ecologist. And on Friday, two baseball interviews.